violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcasts, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Doge damage to the African-American middle class and how one fired federal worker is letting this setback be a setup for a new life path. And great evils like the Holocaust, slavery, and destruction of Gaza are carried out not just by psychopaths like Hitler, but that quiet next-door neighbor, that ambitious colleague, or the man looking to get the house of the family disappeared last week. Elizabeth Minnick, author of The Banality of Evil, joins us. Good morning. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, when Donald Trump and several of his cabinet members gathered in the Oval Office Monday in a meeting with the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, aka the coolest dictator, Trump issued a sucker punch to American democracy. Instead of announcing that he had followed the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling and facilitated the release of Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia, the Maryland man the administration admitted they deported by mistake, Trump and his sycophants claimed they had no authority to bring him back to the U.S. to his wife and three children. After admitting in court that Trump's gang deportation team made a, quote, administrative error and deported him by mistake, they now say if Garcia does somehow find his way back to America, they will arrest him and deport him back to El Salvador. The attorney who admitted it was a mistake to arrest him initially has been fired. Trump went on to ask the El Salvadoran president to build 5 more gulags because he may want to send more prisoners, including what Trump called homegrown criminals. In other words, American citizens who have committed heinous crimes. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor has stated that Trump's interpretation of the ruling basically would allow his team to pick up an American citizen off the street, force him or her onto a plane and deport them to a torture prison in El Salvador without a chance to defend himself or exercise their due process. Well, political analyst Zach Kimball is the co-host of the Find Out podcast. He had this reaction.
Today indicated that it will defy a U.S. Supreme Court order to facilitate the return of a man who was mistakenly deported to another country. In a meeting in the Oval Office, the president of El Salvador said he would not return the Maryland man who was sent to his country.
How can I return him to the United States? Like, could I smuggle him into the United States?
Or smuggling is the illegal movement of goods. This is not smuggling because it's not illegal. It's in compliance with federal court orders. Then he says he's a terrorist.
How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States?
But there's no evidence to support this accusation. But Marco Rubio claims
he was illegally in the United States and was returned.
Not true. Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia was legally in the U.S., has been living here for a decade, and has never been charged with a crime. Even the Trump administration admits he was illegally deported because of an administrative error. But even if he were a gang member, there is a legal process for removal. The president can't just declare you an enemy of the state and get rid of you without a hearing to present evidence to a court.
And no court in the United States has a right to conduct the foreign policy of the United States.
Think about what this means. The White House is saying the federal government can pick up the wrong man off the street, send him to another country, and then do nothing to get him back. And even when courts do intercede, the White House secretly flies planes to El Salvador and pretends they didn't get the memo from the judge, or the judge's orders weren't clear, or they weren't written down so they don't count. Oopsie, said the president of El Salvador when this happened just last month. They pulled this stunt with a gay makeup artist and a professional soccer player, and they're trying to do the same thing with college students too. Last week, a unanimous Supreme Court ordered Trump to facilitate Garcia's return. Not only has Trump refused to comply with the court orders, but he claims he has no leverage to influence El Salvador. At the same time...
That was Keith Boykin, political analyst. When billionaire Elon Musk danced across the stage with a buzzsaw symbolizing the cuts his Doge team intended to make to eliminate government waste, It revealed how callous, insensitive, and reckless his team had been conducting operations. As a result, an unknown number, upwards of hundreds of thousands, have been fired, rehired, and offered packages to retire. The federal government is the largest employer in Maryland, and more than 65,000 federal workers live in Prince George's County. According to an analysis by the Metropolitan Council of Governments, the median salary was over $110,000 or more. As a result, PG County was the wealthiest majority Black county in the United States. Indeed, throughout the state of Maryland, Black families relied on federal jobs to build strong middle-class communities for decades. Shanice Mundell grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and in February, she was fired from her position with the Office of Personnel Management for, according to DOGE, her performance. This despite the fact that she was recently promoted. Ms. Mundell says she is currently pretty much in a state of limbo. She joins us this morning in our WPFW studio. Good morning, Ms. Shanice Mundell, and thank you for joining us this morning on What's at Stake. We reached out to a number of individuals who are not yet ready to speak on their experiences, so we sincerely appreciate your willingness to help us put a face and a voice on this crisis. And unmute yourself.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So up until 2 months ago, you were a specialist in the healthcare and insurance division of the Office of Personnel Management. When and how did you find out you were being fired?
I found out on February 13th. Actually, we received an email, and when we signed in on the in our email, it was a message to go have a team to click on a Teams call. And when we clicked on it, it was a pre-recorded message from, I'm assuming it's the new director of OPM, Office of Personnel Management. And he basically told us that we were all in our probationary period and we were being fired. And this was about 2:30 and we had until 3 o'clock. That afternoon to pack up our belongings and leave the building, and we would be our access to the system would be restrict. We would no longer have access to the system, and that's basically how I found out I was fired.
So you had 30 minutes basically to clear out your belongings and leave. Mm-hmm. So did they give you any kind of written notice and that you know? As to why you were being fired, they said you were on probation. I don't know if that's a reason to be fired, but
yes, he said that we would receive an email after a follow-up email telling us why we were terminated. And once I received my email about the termination, it said it was due to my performance.
And so, how did they come to that conclusion? Did they speak with your supervisor that you know of or review any performance reports on your part?
No, not that I know of, because actually my supervisor wasn't even aware of the call that we were getting when we were fired. It was about 75 of us on the Teams call when I was fired, and she had no idea. My supervisor, her supervisor, the director, no one knew.
Wow. So you were actually hired in August of last year. So were you were targeted because you were a probationary employee. So for over a decade, you worked at the MedStar Health Company, and you worked at the Air Force, in the Air Force as well. What made you decide to come to the federal government?
Working at MedStar, I enjoyed my job, but there was no room for growth. So I either could be a supervisor or a team leader. And they had already had supervisors and team leaders. So it wasn't anywhere for me to grow within that department. So I'm sorry, my dog's barking. I'm sorry about that. So I wanted to find another job where I could have growth in it and, you know, more opportunities. And the federal government had always seemed to be a stable employer. At least that's what I'd heard. So when I decided to apply and I was offered the position, and during the interview process, I was told that, you know, there was room for growth. And so I took that, you know, that leap of faith and went on and applied and was offered the position and accepted it. And I actually did have room for growth because I'd started in August, and by November, I was in another position.
So part of your reasoning was for the security that the federal government offered?
Yes.
And how long was it, Shanice, before you were actually fired? Was it 6 months or how long was it?
August. Yes, 6 months.
Wow. So what kind of an impact has this had on your life? We can't hear you right now. For some reason, it froze.
Well, right now it's never been something that I've never experienced. I'm sorry, without a job, something I've never experienced. And it's, you know, I'm the sole provider for my household. I have a mortgage. I have, other bills that I have to pay, and I don't have a job. And it's just, you know, everything is just turned upside down right now. It's very disheartening to be treated this way by my country that I have served and I wanted to serve. And it's just uncertainty right now.
You said, do you have children, perhaps? I was my understanding you have children.
I do. I have two adult children, and I have a son that's 17. Okay. He's a senior in high school.
And has this impact? You have a daughter that you put through college?
Yes, my daughter did just graduate. She graduated last year with her master's in accounting. So she's studying to take her CPA exam.
Mm-hmm. And so how are you making out without a job at this time? How are the bills getting paid? How are you, you know, supporting yourself? Is your mortgage in jeopardy? Has Maryland helped at all?
Well, my daughter is helping me with the bills at this time. And I also filed for unemployment, which unemployment does, it just covers my mortgage payment. So there is, I did apply for a grant through the Veterans Assistance in Maryland, and I was approved for that. So that did help for a month of my bills.
Just 1 month?
Yes, it's a one-time grant, and they base it off of what your bills are for that month.
Has the state of Maryland filled in any of the financial void at all on any special programs, food pantries, or anything of that nature?
There are food pantries I have seen, and I did apply for SNAP benefits.
Okay. How has that gone? Because there are reports that it's difficult to get through to those offices, the SNAP.
It was pretty quick for me. Probably, I don't know if it was because I applied as soon as I was fired.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it is now because there are so many people that are laid up, that have been terminated now. So I'm sure the volume has picked up since then.
So you, Shanice, you appear to be a woman who has held a steady job for most of your life, well, not all. You put your daughter through college, you bought a home, and to have your life bulldozed like this, so to speak, must be extremely challenging. Yet you seem to be holding it together. You seem pretty stoic. What's your source of strength?
Right now, God is. I have a strong faith in God, and I believe that He is going to get me through. I do believe that I have to do my work as well. I can't just lay down and just wallow in what's been happening, because it's I'm not the only person it's happening to. I'm not going to be the last person it's happening to. So I just feel like I have to fight. I can't just lay down and take it. I'm going to keep speaking out, getting my story out, getting everybody else's, because my story is a lot of people's stories. Like you said, people are not ready or afraid for whatever reason. You know, they have their own reasons of not wanting to speak out or not able to speak out at this time. So I just feel it's my job to, you know, speak out. And I think that God has put me in this position for a reason. And I think the reason is I would like to run for political office to try to make some change.
Well, have you decided which office you're going to run for?
I'm thinking about Congress. My congressman, I've been emailing, calling his office, you know, looking for resources and looking for him to do town halls. He's not, aside from the auto replies email saying that he agrees with what the administration is doing. That's the only thing I'm getting from him. That's the only thing I've heard from him. There's no town hall. So, I mean, I think that if I didn't vote for him, or if I did vote for him, I'm his constituent. And I feel like it's his responsibility, especially if he's agreeing with what the administration is doing, for him to contact me, contact his constituents, and let us know what it is he agrees with. And he's not doing that. So I feel like, you know, maybe he's been in office for a while. Maybe
it's time. Who is this you're referring to?
Andy Harris in Maryland. Okay.
So, well, your job situation is still pretty much in limbo right now, is it not? So what's the official status? What's your official status?
Well, I was fired, and then I was brought back last week. They sent us an email saying that due to the judgment in Maryland, we were going to come back on administrative leave. And then I believe the next day, the Supreme Court or a higher court said that they didn't have to bring us back. So we received another email saying that they're speaking with the legal department to see if we are actually going to remain back on administrative leave. So right now, I don't know. Any day I can get the email saying that I'm not on administrative, I'm fired again. So.
Well, Shanice Mundell, complete success to your next endeavor. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on What's at Stake. Well, just as Shanice's status is in limbo, so are the statuses of countless other federal workers who are anxiously awaiting court rulings. Daniel Horowitz is an attorney for the American Federation of Government Employees. He's acting director of the Legislative Political Mobilization Department, and he's fighting for the federal workers in the courtroom. Good morning, Attorney Horowitz, and thank you for joining us on What's at Stake.
Oh, thanks so much, Verna. Just for clarification, I'm not an attorney. I'm a legislative director with AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, but we are indeed fighting in court for Shanice and thousands of other people like her who are being unfairly treated by the administration.
Okay, well, thank you for that correction. Shanice said Doge just showed up, you know, just sent them an email and you know, identified that she was being fired because of her performance as a reason for her being fired. But there had been no review, no consultations with her supervisors. And now you know, there are some jobs, I know there are some jobs where you can be fired just because, but the federal government workers are being fired in a manner. I didn't realize the federal government was one of those jobs. Your thoughts about that, Horowitz?
It's a travesty what's going on. The history of the modern civil service system goes all the way back to the 19th century. Because before that, we had what's called the spoils system, where every new administration would just put in their cronies. And clearly, Trump wants to go back to that prior system. And one way he's going about it is by trying to fire all the people who were, quote, probationary, who were serving usually in their first year or two of employment, because they have lesser employment protections. Once you've served that probationary period, as it's called, You get a level of tenure protection, which is supposed to insulate you from political changes so that we get the best and brightest people serving in government without excessive political interference. Well, they've torn up the rule book by saying all these employees in their first year or so were unsatisfactory performers, which is ludicrous on its face, and they've tried to fire them all. So why are they doing this? Well, A, to try to reduce the size of government and its essential functions with no safeguards, and B, so they can situate their own political allies back into these jobs. So those are very bad reasons, and we're doing everything we can to overturn it, get people like Charisse back to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that they're also asking the courts, and I think they won this request, to have access to the personal data of the members at the Department of Education, the Treasury Department, and the Office of Personnel Management. Why do you think they want their private data? Do you think it's perhaps to be able to back up or prove a case or something if they, you know, that they were not performing well on their job? What are your thoughts about that, Daniel?
Well, it's very hard to get into the head of Elon Musk and Donald Trump. I'm not sure it's a place I would want to go. But one possibility is they want to look into the political leanings and beliefs of employees, which are irrelevant to their job performance, and try to determine whom they should get rid of. And we've seen cases like that already. You mentioned the Department of Education, and there they are specifically firing people who were members or leaders of the union, of our union, actually. So this gets to their mindset. They want to remove people who are appointed based on merit and put in political loyalists who will do their bidding.
Mm-hmm. So some probationary employees that had been fired have been actually returned to their jobs, but others are not. Do you know why there is that difference?
It's a very complicated picture right now. We had some initial success in the courtroom, and there was a separate case in Maryland that your guest alluded to. But then there was a reversal at the Supreme Court, and now a lot of folks are back into a kind of legal limbo. Some are administrative leave. So it's going to have to await further court decisions. The Supreme Court decision was more on the issue of what's called standing. It's a legal doctrine as to who could sue rather than the merits of the case. We believe the merits of the case are really unassailable. You can't just say that all these thousands of people were universally poor performers with no evaluation of their actual performance. Many of them, I'm sure your guests included, were excellent performers, and there was documentation of that from their supervisors. So we're going to continue to fight that case.
Well, she had just been recently promoted, so we know that she was performing well. But were all of the federal government workers who were fired, were they all probationary workers, or were there others that were not on probation that were also fired?
What we're seeing is a multi-pronged attack on the government. So it's not just probationary employees who are being fired, but in parallel with that, there are what are called RIFs, reduction in force, where they're going after employees who are already not on probation and saying their functions are unneeded. And we saw that very early on with the DEI programs and civil rights programs, and now in lots of other functions that this administration simply doesn't want, like the Department of Education, USAID, many others, they are pursuing these RIFs. And then they've, in other cases, still simply fired people that they don't want, saying the president has some sort of inherent authority to do that. So there are many different things going on. All of them are very negative.
Hmm. So some are actually being told to accept a buyout or be fired. It's the Deferred Resignation Program 2.0, and they were given until earlier this week, April 14th, to make a major decision. Take the buyout or get fired. What's the more prudent option, in your opinion, Daniel?
Well, it's going to depend on a case-by-case assessment. But unfortunately, People in that situation, people like your guest, are going to need legal advice and all kinds of other advice on how to proceed in each case. But it's all very unfortunate, because let's not lose sight of what these people do. People like Shernice signed up to serve the American people. These are people who work in environmental protection. They are people who inspect the safety of our food and drugs. They are people who provide funds and oversight to educate our children. So they're doing all kinds of essential work for the American people. They should be allowed to continue doing that. And instead, they find themselves in all sorts of bizarre legal situations that they now have to try to extricate themselves from. And it's a tragedy. It's going to do damage for decades to come, because young people who are considering careers in public service are not going to want to take this on with all the risks involved. So we need to stop what's going on and get back to what public service is supposed to be, which is an inspiring career for people like your guests and hundreds of thousands of others.
Mm-hmm. So I know you're not an attorney, but do you know if there are pro bono attorneys available for some of these fired employees?
There are a lot of people, lawyers taking on this work. There's also, for people who are in the union, like our union, American Federation of Government Employees, we help defend those cases. So we represent 800,000 people across the government, and we're doing our best to defend their interests using our legal staff. And of course, we don't charge fees for the people we represent.
Okay, so 800,000 employees. How many have been hit by this DOGE attack?
It's impossible to say, but it's hundreds of thousands for sure. And one of the things this administration did in the past month or so is try to drive all those people out of the union. And the way they did that is by a false and really outrageous assertion that almost all the government is engaged in national security work. Even agencies like the EPA are saying it's a national security agency and can't be union members. So they're trying to drive those people off, eliminate their union rights, and eliminate their access to representation to defend them against what the administration is doing.
You said trying to drive them out. How are they, what are they, just coercing them, or do they have some other means of forcing them out?
Well, what they've done is said all those agencies, including VA, Veterans Affairs, EPA, Department of Energy, are all national security, and no one in there can be represented by a union. So all these collective bargaining agreements, they're called, that have been negotiated over the years, they're refusing to abide by. They're refusing to collect union dues via payroll, which is their legal obligation. And they are expelling unions from federal buildings and so forth. So they're doing everything they can to make employees at their mercy, as it were.
Wow. Daniel Horowitz, Acting Deputy Director of the Legislative, Political, and Mobilization Department of the American Federation of Government Employees. Any final thoughts, Daniel?
I think one positive development is that what the administration is doing is too much even for some Republicans, and there's now a bipartisan bill in Congress, the Protecting America's Workforce Act. It's a golden Fitzpatrick bill and has five Republican co-sponsors, and it would undo some of what this administration is trying to do, specifically this outrageous assertion of national security. So we're going to be working hard in Congress to advance bills like that. There's also a MacGyver bill that would reinstate the probationary employees, so we'll fight for that.
Okay, thank you, Daniel Horowitz. Up next, carrying out a campaign of extensive evil, such as the Holocaust, slavery, and the destruction of Gaza, it takes more than just a psychopath like Hitler. It could be your quiet neighbor next door or that ambitious coworker. The Evil of Banality, author Elizabeth Minnick, joins us next. Stay with us. Back in 60 seconds.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of April 14, 2025. On Wednesday, April 16th, from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at the Metropolitan Washington AME Church, 1518 M Street, Northwest, D.C., D.C. area community activists and federal workers are holding a D.C. Emancipation Day Speak Out. Standing together to fight the power, focused on protecting D.C. home rule, saving federal jobs and services, and supporting vulnerable D.C. neighborhoods. For more info, check out WPFW's website, wpfwfm.org. Thursday, April 17th is the timely webinar, Lessons from South Korean Resistance to Authoritarianism and the MAGA Global Playbook, presented by the Institute for Policy Studies from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. More info and registration can be found on ips-dc.org/events. Also on Thursday, April 17th from 6 to 8 p.m., nationally recognized writer Amanda Miller Littlejohn, author of The Rest Revolution, How to Reclaim Your Rhythm and Conquer Burnout When Overworking Has Become the Norm, is speaking at a book talk in Old Town Alexandria, Community Waterfront, 201 North Union Street, Suite 110, Alexandria, VA 22314. For more info, please visit Rest Revolution Book Talk. eventbrite.com. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, Elizabeth Minnick, PhD, divides her time between Charlotte, North Carolina, where she's a professor of moral philosophy at Queens College, and Washington, D.C., where she's a senior scholar at the Association of American Colleges and Universities. She authored several books, including The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy, and of course, The Evil of Banality, which we're going to unpack this morning. Welcome to What's at Stake, Professor.
Thank you so very much. It's an honor to be with such good people doing such important work.
Well, thank you for that. Yes, indeed. We are blessed to have Shanice and Daniel as well to sort of help shape the narrative of what this very critical historical moment in our history. You write that extensive evils are actually carried out not by psychopaths like Hitler, but by people such as your quiet next door neighbor, your ambitious colleagues. And you go on to write that there are simply not enough moral monsters to do the long, hard work of extensive evils. So my takeaway from that, Professor, is that there's a moral monster that triggers the extensive evil, like a Hitler, or I would say a Donald Trump, but it requires a host of ordinary, mundane, pedestrian people to carry it out, banal people, ergo the title, The Evil of Banality. So correct me where I'm wrong. I know there's probably some stipulations in there.
Well, I'm a philosopher, there are always distinctions to be made. That was very nicely done. Thank you, Verna. What you're working with is a distinction that I came to from decades of trying to understand how such things as genocides and enslavement, enslavement being the basis for whole economies and cultures and so forth, many horrible regimes that did such great wrong. The minute you're outside of it, it's evidently horrifying. Things that people would call evil, whatever their theological or non-theological standing, where we say that is really unthinkable, unspeakable. I wanted to understand how those things were actually possible. What was going through the minds of the people who did them? I wasn't focused on immediately right now. My book came out actually in its before the expanded edition. It came out just after Donald Trump's first inauguration. So I've been thinking about this from, in a sense, from a distance, but very close in through personal testimonies and so forth for years. And the question was, basically, how can the most massive harms be done, the ones that last for a long time and become normalized? Those are the ones I call extensive evils, the mm-hmm. ones you've mentioned, mm-hmm. right? I realized as I read and talked to people and listened and so forth, did research, that the these kinds of evils are in fact quite radically different from the ones I came to call intensive evils, which are the ones we tend to think of when we want to explain, to understand what's going mm-hmm. on. The intensive ones are extraordinary. They shatter the ordinary. They're anything but normal. And they're usually done by one or two people, small group, and then they're over. And the ordinary, the rich and wonderful ordinary can reinstate itself.
Give us an example of an intensive evil.
Jeffrey Dahmer, cult killings, sects that abuse children. Those can extend for a while, but they don't extend for years and years and years, and they don't become normal. People mm-hmm. are shocked by them. Mm-hmm. They don't require a lot of people to do them, exactly. I'm hesitating because, of course, nothing is neat, and one could say that the a mistaken has admitted deportation of even one person, taking that person to a notorious not be jail, penitentiary in another country and refusing to make good the mistake, is it one of those stitches between intensive and extensive.
So it doesn't really fall into either category.
That's right. They work mm-hmm. together, mm-hmm. obviously.
One thing we know it's evil.
We know it's evil. We know it's evil. And when a whole a regime, a country, a culture is moving into extensive evil, that takes time. You can't found a whole economy on enslavement, a whole international economy on sexual slavery. You can't certainly do genocide. You can't just set it up and start doing it. Mm-hmm. You need engineers like Eichmann in the case of the name that people most know with the evil of banality and the banality of evil. You have to have whole systems, and you have to have many, many, many people going along with it. When they're entirely set in, totalizing. Religion supports it. Science supports it. Wow. Convention supports it. Novelist arts support it. It's daily speech. People have jobs. In Rwanda, I talked to people, and there are records of people writing about this now. That's 3 months, shorter one. But there's no question of, you know, an effort at genocide. People got up, they did their jobs, they went home. Their jobs were killing, often neighbors, co-religionists, people they hung out and drank with, they would say, in the evening. But they would meet their team in the morning and go out and do their job, then reconvene in the afternoon, collect their spoils, think about what they were going to do with all the things they'd gotten in doing this. Read is always a part of this. Then go home.
And that's extensive evil.
That's extensive evil. Mm-hmm.
So when you say that their systems need to be in place and that all these different organizations need to participate, you said scientists need to participate, the religion needs to support it, et cetera. So what do you think, do you see that those structures being put in place now by the Trump administration? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, what we've just been hearing right now, so we've been taking that in, and I have your good guests in mind here. If you wish to turn a whole cultural meaning system, governmental system, economy, if you want to turn everybody's minds and ways of being in the world to your purposes. That's a lot of people. And you have to undo the cultures, the safe places, the work that the people in them do, the people who do that work. You have to undo the bonds between and among people and their efficacy in the world. Mm-hmm. You have to shatter and splinter. When the Nazis went to Norway, for example, where they had a lot of opposition because of a very strong union, particularly teachers, which is extraordinary. And when they went after the teachers, they had a very strong union, and they said no. And they actually paid a very small price because they were so strong and there were so many of them and they were so respected. And the Nazis were not ready yet to take that on. So there's, you have, but they did go right after education. They go after education, they go after culture, the Smithsonian here, the most powerful of the universities. If you break them, the others are terrified. So it's quite evident that there's a totalizing effort going on. There's no question that's what's going on. And what that does, in addition to the obvious of breaking the functioning of pretty much all that has sustained our shareable lives, as Toni Morrison used to put it. It's a wonderful phrase. And I've been thinking about the commons of the mind, and the commons where we can meet and speak and understand each other, where we know each other. When you break those possibilities from our personal experiences of our colleagues, our fellow students, the people we work with in any kind of situation, our communities, when you break those down and splinter us and we become isolated, and the services you turn to is, one of your guests was talking about it. As soon as she lost her position, she turns to services. And you asked, what's Marilyn doing? These are sustaining functions that give us collective power and agency and protection and security. Mm-hmm. Shatter those and we're isolated atoms. And very quickly, people can come to say, I can't do anything. I have to shut up because I'll get in trouble. Because the intensive evils are also evident now. So people are isolated, having, when you undo those holding places for the whole country and society and our traditions, everything we've believed in, you undo that, you start isolating people. We start looking then for other services, which some of which are still there. That's wonderful. They're crucial. Your other guests, crucial work, absolutely. Then they're still, a lot of them are still there.
Now
we're in a good position in that respect.
You know, when you talk about breaking down the bonds between people, I have a friend who has been saying since all of this started, people are going to start turning people in, ratting on people. And then I heard on the news last night that a confidential informant told ICE that Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia was a member of a Salvadorian gang. And of course, we know the truth that he was mistakenly deported to that gulag in El Salvador, a completely innocent man. Is that what you mean when you write in periods of extensive evil, people little different from you and me do its work for no more than a better job, a raise, the house or the house of the family that disappeared last, that was disappeared last week? Is that what you mean?
It's exactly what I mean. And I understand, I ran across reference the other day to, I think it was two websites where you can sign up to report people.
Oh.
Yeah. What happens, let me put it this way. With extensive evils, one of the key lines that's both empowering and terrifying and moves to your point, we've been emphasizing the other one, is they can't do it without us. No few people can commit genocide. No few people can enslave and build an economy, et cetera. They cannot do it. It has to be normalized. And you have to have a lot of workers to do it in all kinds of roles to get it set in, become systemic and last. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we, the people, have a great deal of agency. We can stop it. if we just say no. When they say, as they did with under George W. Bush, to librarians, you know, tell us who's taking out which books. And the librarians just said, no, we don't do that.
Mm.
And they didn't send the troops in after everybody's beloved local librarians. So what happens is that people get isolated, one, people get tempted, people fall into the kind of thing we've certainly seen with some of the huge law firms, where you have people who do not need their jobs, they want their jobs, and some Republican legislators, you could say no. You don't have to do anything you're told to keep your job, to protect your career, to earn status. That's where I found the motivation. Not great hatred, not great personal evil, not some kind of psychotic madness. Going about their ordinary lives as they have been, I'm afraid these things could not happen if far too many of us didn't say, well, yeah, but you know, I like this job. If I stay here, I'm going to make more money. It's important to me to stay here, so I'll do it.
And what can I do?
And which I? You?
No, I'm saying that's what the...
What can I do anyhow?
Yeah, might say. Well, one of the most basic conclusions that you came to, which you have come to, is that people who are not thinking are capable of anything. Expound on that for us, if you will, Elizabeth.
Yeah, that was one of those moments when you sort of stop and say, this is what I'm seeing. This is really shocking. I had read a whole series of interviews and of people who did horrific things, who did the worst of the work of extensive evils, the actual torturers, the actual killers. And I was reading a long book-length study of a man they called Prime Evil in South Africa, apartheid South Africa, who was well known for doing that work. He was studied by a psychologist from Harvard. And one of the things that kept coming out, he said, one quote that just leapt out as summing it all up, he said, you know, it's not as if you think about it. You don't think about it. You just get the job done. And when you do that, he said, you can go deep and dark, very, very deep and dark. You just shut off your mind and you get the job done. Well, that's quite common. People, we go about, astonishingly enough, it extends to many of us in our daily lives and our jobs. When we turn our reflective minds off, when we're running on the tracks that are familiar, we're within the term of the job, we're within the terms, the conventions of our neighborhood, our friend groups, whatever, we're working away in them, they serve us, and our minds just glide along on those tracks. Banality is a threat all the time. I mean, banality is the ordinary with the life drained out of it. It's when we're on autopilot. Mm-hmm. You know, we're speaking a technical language and we no longer ask ourselves what the implications of the meaning of that technical term is.
So, you know, it sounds like you're saying, Elizabeth, that all the people that are saying, well, you know, they have control of the White House, the Congress, you know, the court's not standing up. What can I possibly do to make a difference? You're saying that kind, is that the people that are not thinking that are sort of capable? Are they sort of assisting this whole process into place?
There are many ways, unfortunately, of assisting it. And specifically in that one, I would say it's a key instance of where we think about these evils when they're developing as well as full blown, or when we're looking at them in history elsewhere. We think about them in these intensive terms, which is they're doing it. That one man is doing it. This is who we talk about. This is who we keep our eyes on. Which is the other thing that happens when you lie and change meanings and contradict yourself. People end up with their eyes glommed onto you, waiting for what you're going to say next, because you don't know what he's going to say next. And that has effect. It's going to affect your life. So we end up sort of looking at one person as if that one person could do it by themselves. They cannot. They cannot. There are concentric circles around, all around, making what one person supposedly says happen. And that goes all the way out. When the further the evil normalizes, destroys the other institutions, crashes them and isolates us and takes our minds away from us doing this kind of lying and so forth, the more there appears to be only one and that we can do nothing. This is not the case. There are still people making it happen. There are people whose job it is. So I think myself, I think from what I've learned, with when it's extensive evil that threatens, that is developing, or that we want to understand, we do. We have to look at ourselves and we have to look around ourselves. Because if we, if every one of us said no, nothing. Police officers can put down their guns. Those are individuals. People in the military who are highly trained, of course, not to think, to follow orders, and to, but who are under the Nuremberg laws actually responsible for following unjust, illegal, immoral orders. That was established at Nuremberg, international. So they are, and they teach this at the military academies. They spend time on this concept. They too are responsible, individually responsible for picking up their guns. In South Korea, some of them turned, they were ordered out against the people when they rose up and they won, as you know. Some of the troops called out, stalled and didn't do things. And one guy turned around and pointed his rifle away from the crowd at the source of the order, not at the people. So it goes from key roles where people can do that to people who just quietly don't say anything, to people who sort of say something about their neighbor they never liked anyhow, or that kind of people that they never wanted in their neighborhood anyhow. And they just kind of shrug and say, well, yeah, pretty good, pretty good. There are going to be houses available. I didn't like having them here. And I'm, you know, yeah, they're coming. I grew up during the McCarthy era and was taught never to answer any questions from anybody who showed up at our front door. Because now, everybody was reporting everybody.
So how would you characterize Donald Trump? I mean, he's comfortable with sending a knowingly innocent father and husband to an El Salvadorian torture prison that reportedly no one leaves alive from, and not lifting a finger to bring him home and suggesting to the Salvadorian dictator that he should build more gulags to house so-called homegrowns, or in other words, American criminals. He launched a trade war that will disrupt the global economy, causing small businesses and farms to tank, people to lose their life savings, allowing Musk to recklessly and callously end the livelihood of tens of thousands of federal employees and threaten the sole stream of income of 70 million recipients of Social Security. All without blinking an eye, how would you characterize Donald Trump? And we only have 2 minutes left. So
the central figure in these orders, who is always having their orders carried out by other people, all the way down to the people who service the airplanes who carry people, you have to remember that. Yes, it is virtually impossible. I would agree with one of your guests. I don't want to inhabit that mind. I do believe that what we're seeing is an extreme of not thinking, lack of awareness. There's no turning back in. There's no, let me do it this way. Thinking is what enables conscience. Conscientia means thinking with. Thinking frees us to think about what we're doing. He does not do that. He just does spontaneously. He's pure impulse. And this is exceedingly dangerous.
Okay. Professor, author Elizabeth Minnick, The Evil of Banality, thank you for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you for everything that you're doing.
And that's it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thank you to our guests, Shanice Mundell, Daniel Horowitz, and Elizabeth Minnick. Thanks to our engineer extraordinaire, Michael Nasella. And thank you, our listeners. Next week, Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo will be the host in the host seat. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late, great Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
I'm Dennis Williams with the WPFW editorial. Kilmar Abrego Garcia, an apprentice sheet metal worker raising three children with his wife in Prince George's County, has been kidnapped by the United States government. On March 12th, Abrego Garcia was pulled over by ICE agents, accused of being a member of the Salvadoran gang MS-13, and then transported to a terrorist confinement center in his native El Salvador. In fact, Abrego Garcia had fled his homeland at 16 because of threats from local gangs, and a U.S. immigration judge in 2019 granted him protection from being deported because he would face persecution if he ever returned. The Justice Department admitted that his removal was an administrative error, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the government to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia, who has never been charged with a crime or found to have any gang affiliation. President Trump shrugged and said that it was up to El Salvador. Salvadoran dictator Nayib Bukele, appearing in the Oval Office, scoffed that the idea of releasing him was, quote, preposterous, while Trump and top advisors smiled approvingly. This is an appalling violation of law and of justice that must not be allowed to stand. If Kilmar Abrego Garcia can be disappeared in this way, none of us is safe. This is Dennis Williams with a WPFW editorial.
Reparations Valley, Saturday, May 17th, a festival of unity and celebration of the ongoing quest for reparations, as well as the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. Speakers include Michael Eric Dyson, Robin Ruth Simmons, O'Malley Yeshitela, Ajua Ayatoro, with virtual remarks from Marilana Karenga, actress Erica Alexander, and Ben Chavis. Performers include the rapper Raz Kaz, along with DC's own Ayanna Gregory, Afi Soul, Lucy Murphy, Nana Malaya and the Malcolm X dancers and drummers, Free Benjamin, Randy Payton, and Laini Mataka. May 17th, Landsberg Park, 1098 Delaware Avenue, Southwest, 11 a.m.
How we gonna make reparations?
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, with an important announcement regarding a national town hall meeting. Report card on Trump, the first 100 days, strategies for resistance and transformation. Friday, April 25th, 7 o'clock p.m. sharp, at the historic Shiloh Baptist Church, 1500 9th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Doors will open at 6:30 p.m. sharp. Speakers include noted political economist Dr. Julianne Malvo, the NAACP's Hillary Shelton, National Urban League's Tara Murray, Diedrich Muhammad from the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and Mel Foote from the Constituency for Africa. There will also be an open mic for you and the audience to share your assessment of Trump and the way forward. For further information, IBW21.org. That's IBW21.org.
Greetings, family. This Wednesday, April 16th, friends, neighbors, and comrades from all across the Washington area will assemble at Metropolitan AME Church for a D.C. Emancipation Day speak out to strategize, organize, and mobilize from 5:30 until 9 p.m. The event, Standing Together to Fight the Power, presented by the Metropolitan Washington Council, AFL-CIO, and the Federal Unionist Network, together with Harriet's Wildest Dreams, Free DC, The Washington Informer, and WPFW, will center how the community can protect DC home rule, save federal jobs and services, and support the city's most vulnerable neighborhoods. Metropolitan AME Church is located at 1518 M Street Northwest in D.C. Details at wpfwfm.org and freedcproject.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.